Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm going to try to talk a little bit about some things that Kate was going to talk about if she'd been able to be here. She would like to have been here very much, but she had to go to Washington, D.C. on short notice, so I was able to come down. She's in that time zone. I'm in this time zone. I work from the University of Washington in Seattle, so it was easier for me to get here. And I'm excited about being here because there are lots of different kinds of people, as not only as we've heard in the talks today, but we've heard in the comments and know from the places that people are representing here in the audience as well. So I'm going to try to say some things that Kate might have said if she were here at the beginning, and then fill out with some stuff at the end to try to talk a little more about how we're approaching these questions of confronting the range of possible different future projections inside the business of trying to understand how we would respond to climate change in the future at the core. So the very first thing, this is just a standard plot that I've adapted a little bit from Kevin Trimberth. And the idea is that you can look for climate change signals and you can even read them in anomalies from any of lots of different kinds of standard hydrologic cycle descriptions. This is a very large scale, the kind of stuff that Kevin has worked on for a very long time and made fantastic progress in his career. But as you can see here, just even from the units themselves, these storage units are in thousands of cubic kilometers. And so you can't really do very much work in a local scale with that. So what we want to do is try to find similar kinds of signals for change. We want to look for those and the threats that we think those are signaling and be able to design some kind of response to that. Not on these global scale anomalies, but down in specific smaller domains. And the problem is that you can open up a pretty large gap. And this photograph I took on the Rio Grande in Big Bend National Park several years ago, we went down, that's the Rio down there, and we actually crossed, this is in Mexico looking back across into the park. It's not clear to me where the wall is gonna go, but I guess now some of my budget is gonna go into that too. So, I'm ready to do the hydrology for the climate change hydrology. I have not been asked to do it yet, but we're ready, prepared. But you can open up a very large gap between the best climate science and what it is that people who are operating. I'm not an operator myself. I'm a senior scientist at the Corps, and I'm a climate scientist. So we're trying to provide information for the operators. But what the specific hydrologic information that they need to be able to characterize both the current and projected future situations can be very far different from where the best climate science is. So on one hand, you've got somebody here with Corps of Engineers blueprints, and he's looking at it, and he says, I sure need a deterministic routing of future Q. And then that question goes out into the air. And what is behind that question as it goes out is risk, I think. And this morning, Janine got us started, and she got very close, didn't quite go as far as I've been trying to drive a distinction that's going to become clear in about a minute. But this distinction between risk on this side, that is trying to understand where the stream flow is and trying to prepare for that. And then when this question goes up into the atmosphere, you guys recognize the scientist from The Simpsons? So over here on the corner. So way on the other side of the gap is the science community. And science community says, he says, well, that precipitation become rain on snow, when, where, how much, for how long, how to represent the uncertainty in that change, use BMA, Bayesian model averaging, with MCNC for the rare events. Oh, I know, maybe create my own method. And this is the response that we get very often from the academic community. And there's just a big discrepancy between what the operator needs to know, this deterministic routing in future Q, and what the academic community wants to work on, which is driven by uncertainty. And now what I was saying just a little earlier about where Janine was is this distinction between risk and uncertainty. And I don't mean it all the way down in the traditional Frank Knight economic idea of risk and uncertainty, but the idea is analogous to that in the sense that if you have measurable uncertainty, then you have risk and you can mitigate that risk. You can't really mitigate the uncertainty. You can work to reduce it on the uncertainty side, but they're not the same thing. And if we treat them the same way, then we won't be answering the kinds of questions that the operators really need to have answered. All right, so I want to say a little bit about what we're doing inside the core. The core has been working since 2010, actively working to try to bridge that gap. And here is an example of our foundational climate change adaptation policy inside the core, which is still in effect, unlike several other agencies who have had lots of their climate change policies suspended or overturned or otherwise eliminated. All of our climate change policy is all still in effect at the Corps of Engineers. And this is, you can still find it. This is, I pulled out a couple of quotes, give you an idea about how wide ranging it is. And I'll try to say a little bit as we go along about the data and tools that we've built to try to implement this policy, to try to help our operating engineers do their work, which is not to respond to climate change. They have day jobs that are important to keep doing under climate change conditions. What we're trying to do is help them characterize those changes and design the kinds of robust responses that would best meet their, best allow them to meet their, continue meeting their requirements under these change conditions. So if you Google up ECB 2018-14, you can find the latest instantiation here of our guidance for incorporating climate change impacts into inland hydrology and civil works studies, designs, and projects. I'm not gonna say anything here. We have a very well developed, much larger set of policy for sea level change, but I'm not gonna say anything here because we're focusing on inland hydrology. But if you're interested, you can talk to me or just Google it up. We have a sea level change being a much easier, I've just noticed that my time didn't start. Ah, Levi, you're gonna have a lot less time. So, was I supposed to start this myself? Oh, that doesn't seem fair. So, all right. So, I'll speed it up. So, if you go, you can. I've just pulled out a couple of pages here. We've got a flowchart that explains how it is that we want people to begin considering climate information to implement the terms of that overarching policy that I showed on the previous slide. Where we are at the moment is in that column of text on the right, saying that what we are requiring qualitative analysis. Those describe how we're gonna apply them, what they're applied for, and what we're doing. We're not requiring quantitative analysis yet because we're still building the tools and the data so that people can apply things quantitatively. And what we're doing, I'll say a little bit more about what we're doing to approach quantitative analysis, but you can see here that what we wanna be able to do is to build tools that allow for the detection, attribution, and projection of individual climate change signals for relevant variables. And then we've been developing a technique for adjusting or hedging the calculated hydrology to be able to account for that increased uncertainty. So how do we do it now? This is a screenshot from a site at this almost incomprehensibly long URL. If you're interested in it, you just Google up downscaled CMIP-3 and CMIP-5, you'll be able to find it. This is hosted for us at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, and it's a site where you can see up the, let's see, can I do this without blinding? Yeah, okay. So you can see up here, these are our partners, which include both Scripps here and Reclamation, other federal agencies, and some private contractors as well, and universities. It was started almost single-handedly and personally by Levi Brecke, who's gonna talk next, and has grown through time. What we have here are downscale climatologies and hydrology forced by those climatologies with different downscaling methods across as many of the GCMs that partake in the CMIP experiments as we can. We distribute, as you said, we distribute freely the climatologies, and then we have hydrology run through VIC, and we do all of this at the CONUS scale because the core operates across the whole country. And we're adding now, we didn't at the time that we started this, we're just finishing now our set of analogous futures for Alaska and Hawaii. But you can see everybody in here has seen lots of these. A lot of the people in here have made similar kinds of plots. And these are just examples to show what would. This is the 4.5, RCP 4.5 future and the RCP 8.5 future with delta temperature, delta precipitation, and then delta runoff. So created these, Andy Wood at NCAR created the hydrology for us here, and we did it at the HUC 4 scale here because that was where we felt comfortable that the confidence that we had in the driving climatology could still be useful for hydrologic input. So there are places, as you can see, where even when the precipitation is increasing in each cases, that the precipitation can increase and that the runoff can decrease. So this is, several people have said through the afternoon that there's a lot going on, effectively said that there's a lot going on in the watershed, lots of other things are changing. Climate change in many places is not the primary driver of change in watersheds, but it's allows you to prepare for the extended change in future. So we've got some additional techniques to be able to try to decompose the changes in the watershed and try to make this attribution. Can you say that the change that you've seen there in stream flow, for example, is due to climate change? So you get these kind of aerial results. Our colleagues at NCAR, including Naoki Mizukami, have created this very large routing, very large, very fast routing system where we can route across the USGS geospatial fabric in any of two ways. All of this is available. Every tool, every piece of data I'm going to show today is immediately available right now. It's just the routing tool, which is called MizuRoute, not only just because Naoki's name is Mizukami, but because Mizu is a Japanese word for water. So the routing, as I say, all of the code's now available on GitHub. We have a publication here in GMD that's cited. If you have any other questions, let me know, and I'll be happy to talk to you about the routing method. So that still produces a lot of potentially conflicting information, and it can be difficult for water managers to understand if you give them lots of different possibilities for the future. So how do we get around this? We saw this, Levi and I co-chaired a meeting several years ago in Seattle, and we were describing our idea about trying to build out the base of climate change information using multiple GCMs, multiple downscaling methods, and multiple hydrology models. And the reaction we got from the applications community was tepid at worst. I mean, it got worse from there. And so we began to think about how we could help make these larger and larger distributions of information accessible for people whose job is not climate change, but is using that information to be able to get on with their job. So what we hit on was the development of these quantitative hydrologic storylines. And what are they? Well, they're, as we say here, modeling chain paths defined for specific hydrologic endpoints. So we've seen a couple of versions of this slide. Sorry that this has come out a little funky. If you build slides on a Mac and then you put it on an Intel machine, you're never really sure what's gonna happen in the end. It seems weird that in 2019, that's still the case. It never happens on Star Trek. I mean, it's just, these quantitative hydrologic storylines, we've seen a couple of versions of these modeling chain ideas. So you start with emission scenarios, you drive a bunch of climate models, you can potentially have a bunch of different initial conditions for those climate models, although that's relatively rare. Multiple downscaling methods, multiple hydrologic models, and multiple parameter sets for those hydrologic models. And what we would like to have, instead of having just a very small number down through here, we would like to spread out the PDFs here so that we can get a better understanding, a better characterization of the uncertainty which is currently hidden. And it's a big deal for us, because if we go back to this distinction I was trying to drive at the outset between risk and uncertainty, if the water manager cannot see that uncertainty, then she has risk that she cannot mitigate. She can't see it, and she doesn't have any way even of understanding it. So what we want to do is not inundate her with the uncertainty itself. We want to provide a means to be able to neck that down in a reasonable way that allows her to have a better representation of the uncertainty so that she can get on with her job of mitigating the risk. So the quantitative storylines would be looking across. We want to run very large ensembles and distributions, but not leave it at that very large distribution of each of these cases, but then build these specific paths that would chart for individual questions, potentially individual questions in locations, of what the future, what the best combination of these different things, different modeling links would be to answer those questions in those locations. And of course, we do it one time, we want to do it multiple times for multiple hydrologic endpoints. We have a paper about this. You can see it here and look it up. This was led by Martin Clark, formerly at NCAR, now at the University of Saskatchewan. So here's a little definition, and I'm not going to read it, but you get the idea that we, again, we want to use the broadest possible ensembles, but then have a means for reducing that so that it's easy to implement, and it, but not lose any information. Once we create the distribution, if you select down from that, then you can at least get an estimate of what the uncertainty is because you've already got the whole distribution. So why do we want them? Well, again, to reveal, characterize, and reduce uncertainty. And we've got to come up with strategies. What we're trying to do now is build strategies for objective subsampling from these increasingly large ensembles. Just as one measure of how big these are, if you look here, if you go to data.gov and you try to look for how many different precipitation databases there are available at data.gov, as of 2 months ago, there were more than 600 different precipitation databases available. So how do you decide what to use? How can you know how to implement the questions, implement tools to answer the questions? So we think this establishes pretty well the need for this information. These are the kind of things that we want to address. We want to, again, look at these gaps in understanding these, where the different sources of uncertainty are to the final answer. We want to be able to reveal that and characterize it for the operators, and then allow the science community to get on with their job of reducing that overall uncertainty in each of that point. So again, we want to be able to keep some of these distinctions between risk and uncertainty separate enough so that the different communities can operate in their own lanes and everybody can make progress. There's a lot of text on this slide. I'm not going to go into real detail about it. How are they made? The key thing, again, is to generate these very large multi-member ensembles and then to draw down from those big distributions these individual paths that are themselves the quantitative storylines. One of the things that makes it possible is multiple different new downscaling techniques. I'm not going to say any more about this, but if you're interested, you can talk to me later and I can point you into information on the Intermediate Complexity Atmospheric Research Model, or ICAR, which was developed by Ethan Gutman at NCAR. There's a paper here in JHM from 3 years ago now, describing the outset of it. It's not fair to call it stripped down WRF, but that's effectively what it is. Our idea, our goal is to get 95% of the physics in WRF and 1% of the runtime. And we're at that now. We've got some hang up in the convection side, but Ethan and some other folks at NCAR are working through that as well. And the reason we think that's important is because we don't see this, people, although we haven't had much discussion here about it, people talk about statistical and dynamical downscaling as though they're two warring camps. And what we see is a continuum across this. And the important thing is to try to get as much physics from the dynamical side and bring that as close as possible to the advantage that you get from the statistical side, which is speed. So what can we do that will help us bring more physics and overcome the obvious limitations that we have in statistical downscaling? If you don't believe there are obvious limitations in that having built all of those transfer functions on the assumption of stationarity, you can look at Keith Dixon's two papers that establish that the stationarity assumption really does cripple the statistical downscaling technique. So ICAR is one method that we're using to sort of speed up that downscaling and to help fill out this spectrum of different downscaling techniques. We're also using a customizable model and modeling framework developed by Martin Clark. called the Structure for Unifying Multiple Modeling Alternatives. which allows us to configure this framework as though it were other hydrology models very quickly, so that it really speeds up the setup time so that we can create multiple hydrologic futures. And then one of the keys is we want to get down to this point here, and to do the sub-selection, we want to do it on something that's more informed than just history matching state variables, because the models and the measurements themselves are so pervasive that you can't determine well enough, you can't rule in or out one or another model representation just based on whether you can hit some climate variable in your own backyard. And one of the things I say pretty regularly is that just because the model can fit the historical climatology in your own backyard doesn't tell you anything, because the model's not solving for your backyard, it's solving for the planet. So in addition to looking at these, what we've got an expanded definition of process fidelity, by which we mean not just whether you can hit these variables in some location, but whether you can build and interpret a suite of metrics that will help increase your confidence that the processes that are in the model represent the processes in the world in a way that you can feel comfortable about using them in the future, where we don't have any measurements to compare them against. But in addition to this process fidelity, we want to look at a range of different climate sensitivities in the models, so that we can make sure that we've covered that range in the global climate modeling community. And then we want to invoke some potentially some ideas that Ben Sanderson and Reto Canuti have been working on for model genealogy, to make sure that we've not fooled ourselves in thinking that we have multiple models agreeing, when in fact the shared physics across those models is such that you probably only got slightly different instantiations of very similar models. All right, so how are they made and what does it look like? We want to interpret model behavior for comparative performance and diversity. So I'm just going to show a couple of really quick examples here of some of the things that we're looking at to get along down this route of building these quantitative hydrologic storylines. So we're looking at percent change in mean annual stream flow. This is from all of these plots from here will be in a future case from the 2080s. And that's not a single year naturally, but from the 2080s down to a historical climate epoch as well. And this is looking at one location. This is on the Yakima River on the east side of the Cascades. And what we're showing here for two different emissions futures, RCP 4.5 and 8.5, and a range of different models and a range of different hydrologic model parameter sets for one model for VIC. So the blue box and whiskers up here, PRMS is hanging out up here. This is VIC with a range of different parameter sets. Trying to draw your attention here that we've got a difference in scale. The scale over here is twice as large. In part, that's because this is the percent change in the mean annual. This is percent change in the low flow, the 7Q10 flow. So what I'm trying to illustrate here, again, is just to say that what's important is that looking not only at the mean change, but to look as the whole motivation for this symposium is that we need to look at extremes, and that when you look at extremes, you can get very different responses. And it's not enough just to show that they're different, but once we reveal that they are different and we don't have any basis for choosing one or another to hand to our operating engineers, then we have to turn some of it back to the science community and have them work on explaining what that difference is. And then potentially using that difference in our own case for building these different storylines. Here's another example. So again, mean annual, this is precipitation change in percent 2080s to the 1980s. And this is segregated by GCM and downscaling method for two different domains. Here again, the Yakima, and here and over here on the Upper Colorado. And again, there's a difference in scale. But these horse blankets are ways that we've been trying to depict what we think the change is from different. Here we have different GCMs, and these are different downscaling methods. I won't go through all the different methods. Some of them I'll say a little bit more about. Here is ICAR, for example, that I was describing earlier, Ethan Gutman's model. Here is a 50 kilometer wharf solution here. Don't worry about these hierarchy that we're trying to work on some cladistics of the different, how well different techniques fit together. GARD is an in-car developed generalized analog regression downscaling method. But the point really is just that if you looked at the two most common downscaling techniques here that are used, maybe. Yep, okay. If you look at the two that are most commonly used, VCSD and LOCA, then you would get a very different understanding of what the possible future would be than if you saw an entire distribution across this. So so I want to say something now about VCSD and LOCA. We've done a lot of work together with Dan Kahn and Dave Pierce for the application of LOCA, the LOCA downscaling method across the CONUS. We've got both LOCA climatology done for that, and then VIC hydrology driven by LOCA for the whole CONUS as well, which is just about ready to be released, and will be released through that Lawrence Livermore GDO site that I was showing in the second or third slide. So again, what we've got here are ensemble mean precipitation changes. These are absolute in millimeters. Again, this difference 2080s to 1980s for BCSD and for LOCA, and then the difference plot here, future versus the current. And then again, just we want to look at the annual max in these cases, and they look somewhat, I mean, obviously there's a very big difference here where we have some topographic relief, and there's probably something else going on up here in the Upper Columbia. But one of the things you can see with this pockmarking is showing us an important difference, and that is that it's not just the difference in the downscaling technique itself, but it's that LOCA and BCSD are trained up on very different observational data sets. And the data sets themselves are not only different. BCSD goes back to Ed Maurer's work, and which is done at 1/8 of a degree. And the LOCA method is trained up on Ben Livna's 1/16th degree. And there's a real difference in those measurements themselves, which can be a very large component of how different the downscaling techniques are. It's not all in the method itself. It's in the training method. And then for LOCA, which has a very different sort of bias correction technique, in fact, a three-stage bias correction, there can be quite a lot of difference there too. This is work done by our collaborators, Ethan Gutman and Joe Hammond at NCAR, RAL, and CGD. But it's preliminary, so don't cite that and don't even remember that you've seen it here. But soon it's going to be ready. So what will they look like? Well, here's an idea of, or, it says I have 20 minutes, but okay. So I'm almost done. Here's what we would try to do to give you an example. This is from a set of projections that were done for the Columbia River, where we used a large range of GCMs and different downscaling methods and different instantiations of VIC produced a large distribution of possible futures. And so if we just pick this Libby Dam up, as you see here, up very near the border, then we will use decision calendars to try to figure out what it is that these quantitative hydrologic storylines should point at. What kind of questions are the operators having, which they need answers to be informed by projected futures? Another way to look at the decision calendar, I'll step along, this is very close to the end. Then we would build these hypothetical, in this case, these baselines. How successful are they now in operating to the rule? How much change is significant for which individual kinds of actions? And what's their risk tolerance, for example, if they miss a target? And then we can use that to go back and try to inform the development of these quantitative storylines, which would look something like that. So my summary, which I would normally step through, but here we'll put them all up at one time. This is basically the sort of thing that we've been saying. That it's not the same to understand and reduce the science uncertainties as it is to work on the hydrologic risk for operations, that we don't want to leave the manager exposed to risks that she can't see or control, and that these large ensembles of models are good for characterizing the uncertainties, but they're bad for actually making these assessments. So that's why we've set out on this path to try to build these quantitative hydrologic storylines with our partners at Reclamation, NCAR, and the University of Washington. And we're very eager to collaborate. So if you see anything you're interested in, talk to me, and we'd be really excited to talk to you. And with that, thanks very much.